saw you then, falling from the way of undue excuses. Settled with your handles, too many that were made as the ties unraveled out of the night, hushing away what no one seemed to mention, while asking us why we can't explain such a beautiful question. Saved at the height of the closing, the caption should say, he doesn't know where he's going. Coming at the heels of returning to your way, chasing empty reasons, none of the lies you left in the way as the drawdowns had ended, gathered in spite your story remains such a beautiful question.
You were just listening to the cut Beautiful Question from Richard Buckner's brand new CD, Surrounded, on Merge Records. And I'm pleased to say he is sitting right here. Hello, Richard.
Hello. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, thanks. This is my co-host, Andy.
Oh, hi.
Hi, Andy.
Hi, Richard.
We've played. I was curious that you did not like want to listen to your song just then that we were playing, which is, I think, a sign of probably modesty, as well as perhaps it's just difficult, right? I mean, you're away from this project, right?
If we can get my therapist on the phone, we can go through it all, maybe.
It's hard to listen to past stuff once you've done it?
It's a couple things. One is, you know, there's memories of doing it where I hear the flaws, the things I wanted to accomplish and didn't. And also, there's a very, when I have to relearn songs for shows and stuff, if somebody requests something, I go back and have to listen to it, relearn it sometimes, I get narcoleptic.
It just makes you fall asleep?
I zone out to the point where I almost fall asleep. I just kind of, once again, we can call my therapist. But
where is he? No, or she.
Maybe it just sends you down a wormhole into your past.
It's probably the least thing that happened. Yeah.
But, you know, as you know, I was there when you performed last night at the Half Moon, which was your release party, so to speak.
Yeah.
Well, like, not so to speak. It was, right?
Yeah, the closest I can come to one. Yeah.
Yeah. For the new record. What, I don't even know. CD, what are you... What do we call
it? I've been saying albums.
Album. Yeah, like album. Yeah, because that could be either vinyl or...
Yeah. Right. Male or female.
Your new album. Yeah. And this is like... You're like 9th or 10th or...
10th or 11th. 10th
or 11th.
There's another one in there, too. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
What I noticed last night is your unique style of performing. I mean, you're a singer-songwriter, but you kind of... You're sort of like a narrator, a storyteller. There's a kind of continuity. You don't take a lot of time between songs. Your songs have a sort of organic life individually, but also seem to stream together in some way. Is that...
Well, thank you. Yeah, you know, it's actually... there was a point a few years ago where the shows had kind of morphed into one long hour and a half piece. I was using loops and stuff, too, and there were no breaks. There were no... There was no chance for a person to get up and go get a beer or something at the ballpark. And I kind of drew away from that because I thought I was maybe isolating the audience. And this is about the closest I've come so far. I used to be a chatty little guy on stage. I don't know.
That's right. I don't think you said a other. I think the only thing you said last night is one more song.
Yeah.
Oh, and that it was a cover.
I used to talk. I used to, but you know, things were wilder back then too. Yeah. Who knows?
Right. You want to talk about? Well, you did have a short, relatively short period with a major label,
mm-hmm.
MCA.
Yeah.
And I gather it didn't work out greatly because.
Yeah.
As these things, I mean, it was part of what was happening right at that moment with the industry changing.
To well, it's a very fair weather work track for a lot of people. You notice a lot of people in the industry are on their way from somewhere to another. Like they go on to become vets or social workers after they leave the thing.
Really?
But you know what it was. Well, first of all, I didn't want to be on. I knew about MCA before I joined them. I'd read about them. I knew their reputation, and they're actually one of the one labels I didn't want to be a part of. But there was nobody else who wanted me,
mm-hmm.
And I wasn't looking for a major. I was looking for anybody, but you know, that's just what happened. What it turned out to be was a very good education in the nature of business, human nature, and the nature of business. The things you are asked to do or told you need to do that you don't really have to do. And you got to kind of do a quick education on your rights. And
talking about promotional things or?
Not only promotional. I mean, you know, there was like, this is like one example. You know, I learned how to do budget tours, found out what recoupables and non-recoupables and what categories you put them in so you're not being charged for things. And
oh, right.
And I took, you know, musicians out with me, and there was a point where they said, well, I'd promised them the work for months, and they were basically saying things like, well, just tell them you changed your mind and send them home, put them home on a bus. that's really the kind of thinking that was going on there, and probably still does it in a lot of, you know, bigger business levels. It's kind of a, you know, I don't know why we expect humanity out of corporations, but
because they're constantly looking at the bottom line, and they see right. I mean,
not in the bottom line, but they're the quarter,
right?
Their week, their month.
That's what I was gonna say. It's a more spontaneous thing. As they see perhaps things not selling the way they had hoped, they start cutting back on what they'll give you.
And they have to, prove something to their bosses.
Right.
Who's gonna talk to them in 30 days? I mean,
would it make sense that you would want to trust them or that you would expect something out of them because they're interested in you and you're an artist to yourself.
Well, it's kind of, you know, the human nature thing. You want to trust people. You want to trust yourself and you want to have that kind of compassion in your life. But, you know, we know just from looking at Congress alone, that's not the case. You
mm-hmm.
know, it's very much about the moment. But like I said, it was a good education in human nature and business. And a very interesting period. I mean, you know, one of the good things was I had very good contracts.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the artwork, for example, I got to do on those two records was something I'll never get to do again. And a lot of artists never get to do, you know, certain things I got to try, promotional things.
You mean the budget for the artwork?
The budget. Yeah. And yeah, and what I was allowed to do style-wise and stuff. They had certain restrictions. And I had a very good contract. I was able to do anything I wanted. And I really had a good time there. And also, you know, honestly... for those two records, the budgets were big enough so I could bring people in from mm-hmm. anywhere and pay them more than what they would have gotten paid anywhere else, and it didn't affect me at all because it came
right.
out of a budget yeah. that'll never recoup. I don't care. I mean, I get statements every year
really?
from Universal
really?
Saying, you know, hundreds of thousands, you're in the hole. It's like, well, it doesn't matter. It's like a
right.
bring of the Grand Canyon. And you know there are rules for when you're making records on, or you were then anyway, on major labels, things about union rules and the types of tape and the types of studios you'd use, and you know, things can be made. You know, nothing against you. I'm pro union, but it's like you don't need to go to a $10,000 a week studio.
Which you've proven in this latest CD, which you recorded
oh, yeah.
in your room.
yeah, yeah, yeah. I I came in way under budget on that. Yeah.
So you record it in your room, and then a sound engineer just cleans it up? Is that how it works?
That's what I've done on a few things, the last two especially, because there was no budget to make the record. Mm-hmm. But I have a lot of equipment that I've collected over the years and gear. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't because it's old.
Mm-hmm.
But it has certain things I have certain sounds, and I know how they work, know how to manipulate them. And so yeah, I'd had musicians in mind and a certain recording environment in mind when I wrote these songs, because the story was already written in my mind. I knew how to come out. The sequence is already in my mind before mm-hmm. it was recorded. And so I thought my idea was to go into the studio and do as much as I could with the song arrangements, fill in all those cracks with melodies and
mm-hmm.
and get as much as I, and then have the musicians reinterpret them when I got in the studio. But when I got done, there was no budget to do that kind of a project. So I had a couple names in my head, people who had worked with friends of mine or had a sound that I thought was appropriate. And one day I had a podcast on when I was cooking, and it was an interview with Tucker Martine. And he was talking about sounds and what he thought about music. And he just kind of sounded like a nice guy, too. And so I just called him, or I emailed him. I just said, hey, I want to send you my thing and see if you'd be interested. I want to see my demos and see if you'd be interested in polishing these up. He called right back, emailed right back. And he, you know, this is a guy who does a lot of work, and it does take years to get time with him sometimes. He was into the album and the songs I sent him anyway, and he had some time set aside for his wife, Laura Veers. And he said he talked to her, and he said they'd be willing to set aside the time so he could work on this project for me. Unheard of for this guy. I mean, like mm-hmm. I said, a lot of people wait years to try and get in the studio with him. But he was available. He made himself available because he was interested in what I'd done on my own. And it was really a great thing that happened, because he, you know, when you're making the whole thing yourself, at a certain point, it's kind of like you're looking at an overpainted piece of furniture. You can't tell what it is anymore. You need that perspective. And he had that. And he did things that were both aggressive and conservative, but appropriate. He pulled back, he pushed forward, he made things happen that I hadn't nuanced enough, and he really made it a much more interesting collection of songs.
That's, you know, I've always been curious about the sound engineer or whatever producer relationship with the artist, and I recently read the new biography of Harry Nilsson, and he had this in ongoing struggle, what people consider his two best albums. He had a phenomenal producer, and then they broke up over decisions because mm-hmm. you know, that was the time when there was a lot of money around, and mm-hmm. and artists were allowed to kind of go crazy, and the result was some albums that could have used a producer like that who told them, no, you know, this is just
This is how I see it,
right? The amazing thing is that back then, his label stuck with him through all that, RCA, through 15 albums, even though he wasn't really making any money. Anyway, right. I just thought I'd throw that in.
Well, it's good that people do stick with. I mean, thank goodness that you know, Scott Walker is able to make the kind of records he wanted yeah. to make, which I'm sure the label is freaking out about. You know, to this day,
I'm still freaking out about it.
The album he put out last year was just, to me, it's a palate cleansing mind blower. Like uh-huh. you know. It's like that movie American Beauty.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really watch it a whole lot, but it's really amazing. You know, it's disturbing.
It sticks with you.
Yeah, it does stick with you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So you think his interest in working with you is because of sort of the turn you've, I don't know if it's a turn, but the direction your work has gone in from being, I don't know if you will reject this, but you were kind of like tagged as alt country type right. of stuff, and then you got into more diverse kinds of sounds.
Right. Well, you know, I wouldn't even be here right now if it hadn't been for the advent of those little Tascam 4-track cassette recorders in the early 80s. Mm. That's what made me want to be musical. I mean, I've always been kind of a writer, but I've never been a real musician. I'm not technical. I don't know any theory. I don't know anything about music. I have my own terminology for chord structures and things like that. But it's about sound and about stumbling upon happy accidents when you're alone in your room for a while working on noise. So, you know, the fact that that first the first record was part of that alt country thing was because I went to Lubbock, Texas and did it with Lloyd Maines and Pawnee Bone and Butch Hancock. I mean, it's a Lubbock sounding record and I love what they did. If I'd gone somewhere else and made a klezmer record, maybe alt klez, I don't know. Like, you know, it could have just as easily happened. You know, I just, I'd heard about Lloyd Maines from other people who'd worked with him. And I needed to make a record for a low budget record that he would, that somebody would take control. Cause I wasn't really a controlling person in the studio. I didn't have enough studio time. I need somebody to just do it for me. And I went down there, we did the whole thing in 4 days, you know, and Lloyd would go like, and there was no planning. It's like Texas style. He's like, let me call, this guy and see. Okay. Yeah, he says after his wife gives him supper, he can come on down here for a little while. It was not planned out. It was just his buddies. There's a lot of talent in that town. And he got people down there at a moment's notice. And it was all, like I said, we did the whole thing in 4 days. And it's just Lloyd would say things like, maybe I'll put a little a lap on there, or a banjo. Hmm. And he'd go in this closet, in this little tiny studio down there in Lubbock, and pull out some banjo with like one string missing. Oh, this will work. All right, do this. And it sounded great, man. The guy's magical.
Right. The serendipitous things that happen in the studio, I guess.
But, you know, it was after that I really started working with, where I really wanted to think more about doing it on my own and arrangements, screwing with arrangements more.
Do you think that's part of the learning curve of being an artist and a performer, is that you figure out sort of more that you can do?
It takes a lot of study. It takes a lot of time alone. If you have home recording equipment or something close to that, it allows you kind of a chalkboard to make a lot of mistakes and not be in a studio where you're seeing the dollars fly out the window while you're experimenting. But I was always on that bent. I was always very suspicious of something that sounded too close to pop or something that resolved a little too easily. And I always wanted to mess with that as much as I could to see what kind of subconscious result would come out of that kind of, I don't know, what's that game? Django, where you put the, you know, pull thing in and just, things just happen. Right. It's like, I'm very curious about that. Or the Brian Geisen, you know, the word project.
Cut-ups.
To me, that's very interesting and makes things happen that wouldn't normally happen and maybe makes things happen that aren't immediately palatable, which is a more trustable.
So is that how you integrate lyrics into your work? Or do you think of your lyrics kind of being more conventionally narrative and then worked into this kind of sound collage?
I let them move on their own. What I do when I write is when I get the initial, not even idea or word idea, it's more like a feeling. It may be percussive. It may be the way it falls off the lips in a certain way that meets the kind of idea I have in my head for the song, melody-wise, sound-wise. And I'll take those ideas and just kind of let them go, but keep them within the sections so I know which sections of the song they are and where I want things to change within each section of the song. Then what I'll do is I'll take those sections and put them out in prose form and edit them and then put them back in sections. And I go back and forth like that a lot, and it makes the words and the stories take on a life of their own, and I like not being in control of that. And what happens is it also allows the words and the music to work on their own without me involved. So they come together on their own, and I'm just the spotter.
Does it feel like there's a? The process sounds almost like you're throwing up all of the elements and letting them tangle up.
It's exactly what it
and
is.
And then how do you know when you've gotten to a point where you've made a beautiful mess and you need to like when you need to collaborate with somebody or
the eternal question. Yeah. Yeah. It's not something you know. It's something you hope is happening and you have to trust that. A large part of trying to make these albums is allowing yourself to trust others.
Mm-hmm.
And trust, not only trust yourself, because you can't really trust yourself. You're too close to it. You're on the wrong side of the mirror. Letting it go so you can trust other people to say yes or no to things.
So did you feel like you were ready when you sent that email for this album? Mm-hmm. Did you at that moment feel like you were ready, or did you just say, oh, I'm hearing this interview, because you said you heard him on a podcast,
mm-hmm,
and okay, I'm just going to do it. I
was at a point where I knew I was, I could retool words, mm-hmm, and melodies forever. The thing is, I need to get out of my house at some point. So it becomes a record. And that it's happened before where it took a long time for that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So what I have to do is I have to get to a point where I'm comfortable with the sounds that I've made and how they work with the words in general. And then there comes a point where I just have to push that little chick out of the nest in a way and just go, okay, this is going to be, here is the moment. I have to put this moment at a pause and say, this is just what it is. I mean, there's songs I still wish, oh my God, I wish I would have used this other image there. It would have been it would have been clever. It would have been brilliant, but, I can't change it now.
Yeah.
So it's just what it is. Yeah.
Well, you know, the writer Don DeLillo always talks about a man alone in a room, and that's kind of the genesis of the artistic experience. I guess I should say a man or a woman alone in a room.
Yeah, thanks.
also, I think we were talking a little bit last night. We were talking about the influence of finally having a deadline.
Yes.
Apparently, you're working on a project that has to be submitted soon.
In a few days. Oh. I mean, on my own things, I give myself deadlines.
Oh, okay.
I give myself rules each time for the records, how I make them. For this one, I put most of the instruments in the attic, physically out of my reach, that I'd used on the last one, because I didn't want to fall back on those habits, and got a few new things I didn't know very well, because I knew it would make things happen that I couldn't think out too much ahead of time. I forget
about deadlines.
About deadlines. So I do give myself deadlines. They're kind of strange deadlines. They're more handicaps. But I do have deadlines in my head. I think like, well, if I don't do this now, I need to allow this much time afterwards for the manufacturing, and then a tour during this appropriate period. And I need to prepare for that 9 months, a year ahead of time. So that I can kind of make a plan in my head about what's going to happen. I mean, because other things happen in our lives. We have to, you know, move out of our house sometimes, get a new place to live, or you know, somebody else is doing something. You need to plan for that too. In the case of the thing I'm working on now, this is probably the most severe deadline I've had. It's been very good for me. It takes about a year and a half of song notes usually for me to bring together, which I don't look at until a moment when I figure I'm ready to dig into it. And it just takes about a year and a half after each project where I'm ready to start working again sometimes on things seriously, just to give myself a break and not suffer from burnout, which happens very easily. To be very careful about that with myself. In this case, though, I met with somebody in early July, and I've come up with at least an album's worth of material, even though it's not something I think my label would want to put out. It's a much different project. It's more performance-based with dialogue and incidental music. But in terms of a larger piece, like what I was trying to do with Surrounded, it takes the concept I was trying to do with Surrounded, where I had a story in my head, and all I need to do is make a record out of it.
Mm-hmm.
It takes that a lot further, and it's something. It's taken a direction I wanted to go, where I thought I was heading, but it's put it on fast forward about a million miles. And the thing I have now, I just think is, sometimes I walk out and I tell my wife, I'm like, this is ridiculous. I'm laughing at myself. Who's gonna laugh at me when I put this out. But it's a very exciting feeling, because there is nothing worse than feeling you've come out of a project with no kind of education and no kind of progress. That's a big letdown, and that can lead to a serious creative block if you think you're not satisfying yourself.
And that's clearly true from so many performers who remain static and often encouraged by popularity. I think, you know, that could be a trap when you're popular, is that you're paralyzed because you know if you change.
Panic. Panic is a good motivator. I mean, there's a lot of things that happen in people's lives that change for the positive out of some horrible incident or something where they're forced to do something they do not want to do at all. And they end up having to do it, and it turns out to be a good thing sometimes. Yeah. It's like I was talking to you or somebody else last night about, it was about like an example of like, you know, you live somewhere for a long time, maybe you should take a different route home once in a while and see things in a different way, you know?
Yeah. I'm kind of the opposite. But I won't go into that.
Well, not that I don't leave my... I mean, I don't leave my house very much at all.
We're kindred spirits.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, one question I wanted to... How do you now feel then about more conventional 3-minute songwriting? Is that like even still part of your vocabulary anymore?
Well, you know, it's never been a part of... It's kind of when the thing ends with me. You know, I made a record years ago called Since, which had like 17 songs on it. Some were 2 minutes long, some were a little bit longer. And I've also had pieces on the last two records that went very long, maybe too long for my taste. Kind of what I do is I leave myself a lot of space around the idea when I'm recording. So, for example, I set up a foundation for the song first, very not based on melody exactly or a key, just I give myself a space. Generally, it's about 10 minutes of space. So if I'm done with the song, it's 2 or 3 minutes long, but something needs to keep happening, there's lots of space for it to run on. A lot of things I learned from my years of touring with my loop stations and stuff, where I was doing experimentation every night. Every night after the show, it was all erased, and I'd start over again the next day and see what happened. I learned a lot about... I took that into the studio with me after a while. And a lot of times what I'll do... I worked on a film score. It kind of started working well for me with the film score I worked on a few years ago, where I took that idea of leaving the extra time on to work around things. For the film, I based it on this... it hadn't been filmed yet. I based the score on the script. And I had a lot of melody ideas and theme ideas that were being repeated and manipulated. But what I was doing when I did this was I took the melody idea, which could be, especially for a film, in between 30 seconds and a couple minutes, and I would do the specific strict melodies and musical ideas. Then after that, on the same track, and I had 24 tracks to work with, I would let something go and not listen back to all tracks together in that section until it was done. And what happened was I came up with a lot of very interesting textures that I wouldn't have been able to think of on my own. So I continue with that because it makes things happen that I can't control. And it also creates a little more... just artistic space for me to then go back and maybe manipulate or not at all. And in fact, it's funny, the film score, the director ended up using, you know, some of the musical ideas, but a lot of what he used was the incidental stuff that happened, the chaotic tracks afterwards that had no thought to them, but somehow had an appropriateness because they had the feeling of the melody without being the melody or the specific musical idea.
And So when you say that you're creating a space, or you're like setting aside 10 minutes of space for even if it's a 2-minute song when you're first going in, you're saying to yourself, it's I'm starting at 5 o'clock, at 5:10, that's my time space. And then on top of that, you're like putting all of your ideas, like imbuing into your play. Idea in that space before you start.
Yeah. I have a general, when I put the song arrangement together, there's a general idea of how long it's going to be usually. either based on the sections or if I have a lot of words that I need to trim back or whatever. So say I think like, well, it seems like it's kind of just kind of peter out about three and a half minutes.
Right.
Well, I still have 6.5 minutes left to let that one instrument go on that one track and let it do whatever it has to do and not think about the key or not think about the structure of a melody idea. Just let it go. It's kind of like having a giant backyard.
Right.
Yeah.
It's an interesting idea to say, you know, well, I set aside myself 10 minutes of space to work in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can let it go and say that, but to think about that as it's physical. That's a physical way of making work. It's really interesting.
It's you can always say, well, there's always fade out. I don't fade out things very often. But there's always that option too. There's always cutting things off. You can always edit too if you want. There's a lot of ways, but there's nothing worse than not having enough ideas.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'd way rather have a big bucket full of them to pick through.
You might as well overdo it.
Yeah.
The insert to the new album, Surrounded, is sort of unusual. On one side, of course, it's an artwork by Jill Draper, who, is that your wife?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought. And would you call that a lyric page? Not really, right? I mean,
I've been calling it text.
Because
there's no real differentiation between the songs and the rest of the words.
What I was curious about, are you interested in written text without music on your own?
Yeah, I've been a writer since I was a child. I got one of those creative writing degrees in college too. Chico State, in California. Nice, cheap. Was cheap then anyway.
Did you have a mentor there of any?
No, there wasn't anybody. I mean, you know, Carver wasn't there anymore.
Right, I remember that's where he began.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. I had a few guys who I looked up to in other ways, mm-hmm. maybe their philosophy on life and things like mm-hmm. that. But no specific writers or artists who I admired, who I went there to study under or have a mentor as. And honestly, I was very wild then, and I was really just more interested in putting various rock bands together than I was doing creative writing. Mm-hmm. And it's only in the last few years that I've been able to have the clarity to be able to search out the voices for more serious writing. And only in the last like 6 months, I've begun releasing things on Tumblr, just because I want to start feeling out what the stories look like outside of my desk. So I'm starting to release things in the next year or so, more short stories.
And do you think most of those texts will be eventually integrated into some musical form or performance form?
Not the short stories. I keep my writing desk and my music studio separate. I'm strict about that kind of things. Like
that's smart.
I don't bring my I don't bring, you know, business stuff. Like I don't bring my checkbook in the studio, you know, things like that. I keep it very sterile and separate, and it keeps it because it can be very confusing.
Could you come over and help me organize my study?
No, I wish I had a picture of my desk right now. It's not even usable. I mean, I'm at the kitchen table now because my desk is just a big pile. But it's important to keep those things separate for me, because if not, they get confusing and overwhelming, and then I tend to just drop it and then start something new. So I need to keep things organized. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh my God, the mess I have upstairs in that studio is like
a big table full of everything.
It's just, it's disgusting. It borders on disgusting sometimes.
Well, we've been talking with Richard Buckner, who for some reason earlier on I kept calling Bruckner because I grew up not that far from the Bruckner Expressway.
Well, there is a Richard Bruckner who's a musician, actually.
That's funny. Yeah. And we're celebrating the release of his new album, Surrounded, on Merge Records.
Yay!
And I'm going to play one more piece, but I'm going to have him take off his earphones because I know he doesn't want to hear it.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
So take off your earphones. Richard, right, okay. Thank you for coming in.
Oh, it's so nice talking to you.
We're honored and pleased to have you here.
So nice
thank
to talk
you so
to
much.
You. Thanks for having me and talking about real things. It was a pleasure for me.
Great. Yeah. Thanks. All right, Mike. Thank you.
was alive. But a vision left alone, too late to find its way inside. Tried to let you know, showing you out. For the mirror's on the moon, they'll never break it down, only glancing through.
That was quite an initiation for you today. Your
first big show.
Oops. Sorry.
My mic wasn't on, Tom.
I'm sorry. That's because you're...
Can I repeat that? My first big show.
And you were fantastic. I have to say, though, you're not Ellen Thurston. And by the way, our producers came in and said Ellen has been spotted in Vegas.
Vegas, Nevada?
Yeah. I never knew Ellen was a gambler.